Rumon Gamba conducted the BBC Philharmonic in Ron Goodman's music for the 1965 film Those Magnificent Men in Their Flying Machines, and that rounds off the programme. Thank you so much for being with me today. I hope you've enjoyed my musical selection and it's helped your morning go well. I'm actually on holiday next week. I'm leaving you in the capable hands of Kate Mollison. Join Kate at 9 and I'll see you in a fortnight. Sunday Morning is a tandem production for BBC Radio 3. Thanks to my producer Marion Bettsworth and our studio manager in Broadcasting House, John Boland.
Drama on 3.
Who is that? That woman, looking over.
The most desired courtesan in Calcutta.
A classic tale of forbidden love.
She's not for you.
Why not?
For one thing, you couldn't afford her.
I'm a prince.
Such games come expensive in this house.
I don't want to play games.
Charitha Chandran stars in a bold retelling of the story that inspired The Traviata.
There is no way that you and I can be together except in the moment.
I intend to marry Camille.
I forbid it.
You can't prevent it.
Oh, can't I?
Camille, this evening at 7:30 on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
It's just after midday and time for Private Passions, and Michael Barclay's guest is the scientist Professor Robin Shattuck.
My guest today, Professor Robin Shattuck, is at the forefront of vaccine research and development in this country, indeed in the world. For 30 years now, he's been working on a vaccine against HIV, and with his team at Imperial College London, he's been developing new vaccines against Ebola, chlamydia, rabies, Lassa fever, to name but a few. They're still working on a new improved vaccine for COVID, which will be cheaper to mass produce in the developing world. And this technology, they firmly believe, could lead to vaccines against heart disease and cancer within our lifetime. Well, that's very exciting, Robin. I look forward to discussing that research in a moment. But first, music, because before you even got involved with science, I think you started out with a dream of being a rock star. Why did that not come to fruition?
Well, I really enjoyed those days in my teenage and early 20s. And my parents were very concerned that I was going to give up on doing a proper job and spend my life trying to make it as a rock star. But in reality, a few nights sleeping on a friend's floor in a flat with no heating made me realise that I wasn't really cut out for travelling around the country, playing gigs and hoping that I'd be discovered.
Were you playing guitar, electric guitar?
So I started playing on the drums. I didn't have a great sense of rhythm. I moved to electric guitar and really enjoyed that, enjoyed the creative process of trying to write new songs. But we didn't get discovered.
But of course, as well as sleeping on floors, it's a pretty tiring job, isn't it, if you don't have roadies, moving amplifiers and all of that, not to mention drums.
It is a tiring job. But, you know, looking back on those days, while they were fun, I clearly didn't have the talent to make it. When you're young and optimistic, you can imagine all sorts of things that actually aren't going to work out in your life.
But you also played the violin, didn't you, in those early days?
I did. I started playing the violin from the age of 8, so way before I started playing the guitar. And I think classical music I came to first. It was very much present in my family home and it remains something that really I enjoy and helps me relax.
And do the rest of the house enjoy your violin playing?
Well, that I have to say is an acquired taste. My wife definitely hasn't acquired that taste for my violin playing.
Well, your list certainly does betray a passion for violin music, but also for opera and choral music. And we're going to start with Handel, aren't we? His Dixit Dominus, setting Psalm 110. Where did you first get involved with this music?
Well, I always enjoyed singing and I was in a number of choirs when I was a young treble. And singing together as a group is just something that really bonds people together in a way that nothing else does. And I still enjoy working with teams, group efforts, and singing really demonstrates how that can work really well.
Well, a choir that is certainly very good at listening to each other and coming up with a blend is the Choir of King's College, Cambridge.
So I chose this recording because I particularly like it, and I came across it when I was still a child, and it stayed with me for a long time.
Stephen Clebury conducting the choir of King's College, Cambridge, and the English Chamber Orchestra in music from Handel's Dixit Dominus. As we were saying, Robin Shattuck, you took a somewhat unconventional route into science with your plans to become a rock star, and if not that, then a lead actor. In fact, I think it was while you were on stage that you met your wife. It was appropriately a romantic comedy.
That's right. We met playing Barefoot in the Park, which is a lovely American comedy, not so well known now. And both on stage and off stage, we fell in love.
Well, in terms of romantic emotions, the music we're going to hear next certainly ticks that box. It's an aria from Puccini's third opera, Manon Lescaut, isn't it?
That's right. And it's a beautiful piece, and obviously about a woman who really wanted to have everything her own way, a really large personality. And my wife is a large and marvellous personality.
But in this aria, unlike your wife, Manon is singing about a lost love, regretting the choices she's made in life. Kyrie Kanawa in that aria from Act 2 of Manon Lescaut by Puccini. Riccardo Chailly was conducting the orchestra of the Bologna Municipal Theatre. Robin Shattuck, we've talked about your short career as an aspiring rock musician and actor, but we haven't really got to what matters, your eminent career as a scientist. How on earth did you become a scientist?
More by accident than by design. I never imagined that I would be a scientist, although I have to say my mother tells me that that was what I was built to do, because as a child I would always spend my time asking, but why? But why? And really, I only got into science because I had to pay my mortgage and I had some very poor A-levels, scientific A-levels, and started working in what was known as a public health laboratory in a hospital. And having started there, I then started to really see the relevance of science and how it could be transformative. And suddenly something clicked in my mind and I found that I could do it.
Do you think it's perhaps an advantage not coming to science through a conventional route, that you get a different perspective and that you have a wider field of interest?
I think it's always good to have a wider field of interest and not to be blinkered. I think the other aspect for me is that a lot of education is about acquiring knowledge, but not understanding how to apply that knowledge. And I think it's still very hard to teach how to use knowledge creatively. And having come to it later in life and being in a work situation where I was able to apply what I was learning and see its relevance, for me, was important to make it real.
Beethoven next, and you've chosen the Allegretto from his Seventh Symphony.
It's a beautiful piece. It's inspiring. It is more solemn, and it's something that I love to listen to.
It has almost an element of tragedy to it, would you say?
It does, and I guess it reminds us all of our own mortality. And that's important in keeping a perspective in life. We are all biological creatures and heading in one direction.
Christina Poska conducting the Flanders Symphony Orchestra in the Allegretto from Beethoven's Symphony No. 7 in A major. As I said at the beginning, Robin Shattuck, you're now one of the world's leading researchers in the development of new vaccines. And for 30 years, you've been working to develop a vaccine against HIV and AIDS. When you look at how quickly we got a vaccine for COVID, why do you think it's taken quite so long to find one for HIV? Or maybe that helped us find one for COVID.
Well, certainly a lot of the technology that people have been working on for HIV really did help in developing vaccines against COVID. It's kind of unfair to compare the two. Luckily for humanity, developing a vaccine against COVID was not as challenging as we initially thought. And that's because although people are very familiar with us talking about variants of the COVID virus, actually we're talking about a handful of variants. And for HIV, there are more variants of HIV within a single individual than there are across the world for COVID-19. So HIV still represents, to me, one of the biggest biological challenges of a generation. It's going to be very difficult for us to solve, but by working on something that's extremely hard, we'll bring many benefits, not just for HIV, but for vaccine technology in general.
And of course, although you haven't solved this problem yet, the drugs are so good now that people can at least live with it.
I mean, there's been some amazing changes in my career. You know, early on in my career, when people, you know, were diagnosed with HIV, they were essentially looking at a relatively short lifespan. And people who are diagnosed early in infection and can access treatment can now expect to live a normal lifespan. And that's a revolution. But what's really very sad is in many parts of the world, people are unaware of their HIV status. There's still a lot of stigma around HIV. They may not go and get diagnosed or even take the drugs that can maintain their life. And so there are still hundreds of thousands of people who die from HIV needlessly every year. And of course, developing a vaccine would change that.
And of course, the other problem in the developing world is the sheer cost of the drugs, isn't it?
Well, the cost of the drugs has come down very dramatically. And of course, there are huge initiatives to make those affordable across the world. So actually, the price of the drugs is not high. But you have to remember that even accessing the drug as an individual, if you have to take time off work, maybe, you know, spend the day traveling to and from a clinic, that comes at a personal cost. So it's just not as easy to access the drugs in different parts of the world.
Your research has taken you to Africa and I think possibly prompts your next music.
It has indeed. I've been to Africa many times, and I can remember flying down to a conference in Cape Town, getting off the plane, bleary-eyed, straight into a meeting, sitting there and being absolutely spellbound by the fact that in the break, people in the audience just spontaneously started to sing together. And this music, it reminds me of that spontaneity of music that many people have in different parts of the world.
This is Emarabini, a traditional Zulu wedding song, and the lyrics are about an orphan. Who will look after this child, for it is truly without parents? And of course that song's taken on a new meaning as the orphan population in South Africa increases, due indeed to HIV and AIDS. But the song is hopeful, isn't it? Not despairing.
It's full of hope.
Emarabini
Yeah.
Why money? Why money?
Sishu, why money? Sishu, why money? Sishu, why money?
Emma Rabini with the Soweto Gospel Choir. And if you'd like to find details of the music choices of my guest today, Professor Robin Shattuck, you can go to the Private Passions website, and you can also find hundreds of past programmes on BBC Sounds. We were talking just now, Robin, about your very long-term search for a vaccine against HIV, but you also got involved in the COVID vaccine race. And it really was a race, wasn't it? What was the pressure like for scientists like you?
I mean, it was a very pressurised time, but also a very invigorating time. And it seems strange now to look back at the beginning of the pandemic when there were no vaccines. And I think we thought that there was, you know, a 20% probability of any of them working. And at that time in the UK, the government wasn't really clear as to whether it'd be able to get any vaccines from the US or Europe. And so there was a lot of expectation around what we could deliver with a technology that we had never taken into humans before. So we were working around the clock. When I say we, you know, huge team of people working to try and realise the science and recognising that, you know, it may be a difficult challenge. But essentially, we were using the same technology that we had started to apply to HIV, which is to use this new way of harnessing genetic material to instruct cells to make vaccines. So people are probably very familiar with talking about DNA and their genes, which is essentially the knowledge base that makes you you. And that doesn't change and sits in the nucleus of your cell. But when you want to make a protein, the cell sends out a message, and this is called messenger RNA, and that instructs the protein machinery to make new proteins. Well, we use that message and introduce it into the cells and tell it to make proteins against the SARS coronavirus. Now, we had an extra trick to it where we also use a version of this that can copy itself many times over. And that means we can use a much lower dose. And that's important for manufacturing and making it accessible, cheaper, but also will help us when we think about the future where we might want a combination vaccine against COVID and influenza, for example, where using lower doses of two things is much easier if you're starting with a really low dose in the first place.
Why wasn't your Imperial College vaccine the one that was rolled out?
It was earlier technology, and essentially we didn't have a pharma partner behind us. So although we were competitive in the earlier stages, we had less ability to choose and test multiple variants. And so the ones that really won out had billions of dollars of investment. But we were able to demonstrate that the technology works, and that has led to significant investment, the ability to set up a new company now really to champion the technology and take it forward for the future.
Given that you're a scientist, do you find all of these problems about money and investment from drugs companies exasperating to a degree?
Well, I think if you talk to any scientist, they would always love to be given a blank check. And obviously, that's not going to be appropriate as a competitive place. There are competitive ideas. But in terms of international competitive witness, which I think is important. The UK is still perhaps a little bit behind the curve in terms of commercial investment into this new type of technology, where we've seen huge amounts of money being invested in the US and also in different parts of Europe, particularly in Germany, where the Pfizer vaccine originated.
To be a successful scientist leading a team like this, do you have to be a bit of an entrepreneur as well as a scientist?
You certainly have to be an entrepreneur because you have to sell ideas and deliver on those. You also have to be a real optimist, and I think I'm an eternal optimist because science is more often about failure than about breakthroughs. And many times you have to work out why things don't work before you can get them to work really well. And I think people imagine that breakthroughs suddenly happen by some genius jumping from A to Z. But actually, it takes hard work, many years, and many, many people working against particular tasks to make those big breakthroughs.
Earlier this year, Robin, you had a moment of rock star fame when you appeared on Question Time and took on, quite vociferously, an anti-vaxxer. What was that like, and how did you feel being exposed in that way?
Well, it's always a challenge to be on a programme where your every word is being scrutinised. And it was surprising that actually it was my visual expressions that seemed to take off more than what I said. But I think it's important for scientists to engage and to explain what they do and the science behind it. And of course, you know, anybody who has an agenda will look at what's out there and find things that justify their position. And of course, the scientific process is completely different. You set up a hypothesis, you set up experiments to test that, but ultimately, rather than fitting the data to your idea, you have to mould your ideas and your understanding to the data that's generated. And often it takes you in a very different direction.
Benjamin Britten next, and I know you're interested in contemporary music, Robin. You've wrote a piece that's not often chosen on Private Passions, indeed not often heard in concerts. It was composed when Britten was just 21, the lullaby from his suite for violin and piano, a really different sound from your other choices so far.
I like this because it makes you think. I like things that are different and stimulate you and far off different ways of thinking. And this, for me, is exciting because of its difference.
Thank you.
The Lullaby from Benjamin Britten's Suite for Violin and Piano, with the violinist Matthew Jones and pianist Annabelle Thwaite. That's very unlike much of the Britten oeuvre that followed. It's sort of quite, even more modern in a way, don't you think?
I think it's very modern, and I also like it because in some ways it's understated. There's lots of simplicity around it that leave you questioning.
Lots of space.
Yes.
You confessed at the beginning, Robin, to your passion for the violin, and that takes us also to our next piece, the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto. Is this something you've attempted to play?
I've attempted to play it many times and failed, and I'm sure when I retire I'll drive everybody mad by continuing to attempt to play it. My wife tells me that my violin playing is the best way to clear a room in the shortest possible time.
Is it the best way to clear your mind from scientific problems you're struggling with, or indeed to help your mind deal with that? Or do you just see it as a cut-off?
It's a nice escape. I'm always thinking about science, and so to relax I need something that requires absolute concentration. And trying to play a difficult violin piece requires my absolute concentration.
And having given up aspirations towards being a rock star or an actor, is there something about playing the violin which still does allow you to be the performer?
It would allow me to be the performer if I could play it well. I have to say that I still have to realise that. But I think that my interest in acting and in music has helped my scientific career. It's helped in terms of the creative aspects, but also in communicating science. And I think that communicating science is so critically important that people, you know, will understand the scientific process rather than it being something that's hidden away.
Well, we're going to hear the middle section of the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto, the Andante. Leah Biringer is the violinist, and this is a recording released in April this year and made during the pandemic with the players masked and distanced.
Thank you.
Leah Biringer, the soloist in the slow movement of the Violin Concerto in E minor by Mendelssohn. Hermann Bäumer was conducting the Hofer Symphonica, a recording released in April this year. We've been talking, Robin Shattuck, about your vaccine research in some detail, but I'd really like to take on the bigger picture now. What about diseases like heart disease and cancer? Is it really possible that we'll see a vaccine for those?
It's very much a realistic possibility. In fact, mRNA-based vaccines were initially developed to work against cancer. And what is exciting is the flexibility around the approach, because they are essentially genetic code. You can put into them whatever you want to make the cell produce. And in the cancer space, people are increasingly starting to look at what we call personalized medicine, where you can actually look at somebody's tumor, pull out a genetic sequence that's unique to the tumor and differs to any other of your cells, and start to produce that as a vaccine, because the technology is simple and relatively easy to do that. Heart disease, again, whether it's more likely to be applied to helping people recover more quickly if they've had heart problems, a heart attack, for example. And I think that's what is really invigorating at this stage, is that there are so many possibilities that this technology opens up.
Many diseases like arthritis, polyneuritis, are to do with the immune system attacking us itself. And I wonder how much more work there is still to do to understand how that happens and how to correct it.
I mean, there's still an enormous amount of work to do. And I can remember when I was studying for my degree, one of the lecturers feeling slightly irritated that they had to keep saying, well, when I asked a question, they said, well, we don't understand right now. And what is exciting about this area is there's still so much to learn. So, you know, I would really want to encourage young people thinking about a career in science that there are so many things that we need to continue to discover. What we're doing today will seem very pedestrian in 20, 30 years' time.
And what about strengthening our immune system so it can fight off all these diseases? What's the best thing we can do to protect ourselves now?
Well, there's all sorts of quirky things out there that people may tell you, but the best thing you can do is obviously take the vaccine. Vaccines are the most effective public health measure next to clean water and have saved more lives than any other medical intervention.
Well, that's a lovely note to end on, and we're going to play out on a really invigorating collaboration between Yo-Yo Ma and Stuart Duncan, amongst others. Why do you love this so much? Is it the marriage of the two disciplines?
Yes, it's absolutely the marriage of the two things that I love. I love classical music, I love modern music, and I love the way in this piece the two things work together so well.
Robin Shattuck, thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Attaboy from the Goat Rodeo Sessions. That's a collaborative album from 2011 featuring classical and bluegrass musicians, including the cellist Yo-Yo Ma. And that was the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest, Robin Shattuck. Private Passions was produced by Elizabeth Burke and is a Loftus Media production. The programme is back next Sunday at midday, of course. Michael's guest then will be the philanthropist Dame Stephanie Shirley. This is BBC Radio 3 on 90 to 93 FM digital radio and BBC Sounds. The time now is 1 o'clock. Let's get the news with me, Chris Barrow. The Prime Minister has urged the West to stand firm as it confronts Russia's attack on Ukraine. At the start of the G7 summit in Germany, Boris Johnson warned against backing down and allowing President Putin to succeed. A Downing Street spokesman said that in talks with the French president, Mr. Johnson had cautioned Emmanuel Macron that any attempts to settle the conflict now would only cause enduring instability. Ukrainian officials say 14 Russian missiles have been fired at the capital Kyiv this morning. The bombardment has killed at least one person in a residential block of flats. Four others were injured, including a 7-year-old girl who was rescued from the rubble along with her mother. The city's mayor, Vitaly Klitschko, said Vladimir Putin was attempting to intimidate his country ahead of the G7. President Zelensky is due to speak at the summit, where he'll ask for more economic and military aid. Boris Johnson has defended his comments about how long he intends to remain as Prime Minister after claiming he wants to stay in office until the mid-2030s. Asked by reporters if the remarks were delusional in the wake of two by-election defeats, Mr. Johnson said his government was delivering for the people and that it had a huge amount to do. At least 20 people have died at a nightclub in the South African city of East London. It's thought the victims were all aged between 18 and 20 and were celebrating the end of their school exams. The cause of the deaths is not known. Local media has reported they could have been poisoned by a gas leak. Pictures of the Enyobeni Tavern show bodies strewn across the floor and tables with few signs of injury. The Sunday Times has reported that Prince Charles accepted a suitcase of cash containing €1 million from a former Qatari prime minister. The paper says this was one of three large cash donations made by Sheikh Hamid bin Jassim to the prince's charity between 2011 and 2015. Clarence House has insisted all the correct processes were followed. In cricket, New Zealand have made a strong start on the fourth day of the third test against England at Headingley. Earlier, Kent's Sam Billings was called up for the England wicketkeeper Ben Foulkes, who tested positive for COVID-19. The weather, it's windy and cool across western areas, with some showers that could be heavy and perhaps thundery, especially over Northern Ireland. It will be drier in the southeast, with some sunny spells and feeling quite warm. That's the BBC News. It's 2 minutes past one.
Where will the BBC Proms take you this year? To Mozart's Vienna with the Mahler Chamber Orchestra? The forests of Finland with the Oslo Philharmonic? Or the summer heat of India, the birthplace of the Sarod? From virtual worlds at the Gaming Prom, planet Earth as you've never heard it before, or out into space? There's so much to experience at the BBC Proms. Tickets are now on sale.